Melissa Hilliard moved her family from her home in a small town in North Carolina to find work in Atlanta, Georgia. It seemed like a good idea at the time. She got settled. She stopped needing any kind of public assistance. And then she saw the price of food go up and the price of gas nearly double.
Twice a week, I put between $75 and $80 in my minivan. There's not much else that we do. I mean, we go to the grocery store maybe once every 2 weeks. But it's pretty much just getting he and I back and forth to our jobs. The amount of income we've got versus the amount we spend just in gasoline to get us to and from work doesn't leave us any money for food.
Melissa Hilliard had moved to Georgia to take control of her life, but about a year ago, she took her family in to apply for food stamps, and now trips to the food bank are also a part of her routine. She says she has no choice if she wants to balance the family budget and feed her kids. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Even the food banks are feeling the pinch. In Georgia, so many people are coming in these days that food bank managers have been reducing the amount of what they hand out and restricting each family's number of visits. But whatever is happening at the food bank was not supposed to be any concern of Melissa Hilliard. She had moved from rural North Carolina to Atlanta, Georgia to get a decent job, and at first things were going well.
We were here for 2 months. We didn't have food stamps. We were making our bills. And then one day I looked in the refrigerator and there was no milk, and my 4-year-old then came to me and said, "Mommy, here's my quarters to get us some milk." I about cried. I was like, "Baby, you keep your quarters. Mommy and Daddy will figure out something." And she was just like, "But Mommy, we need milk and you don't have any money." And she didn't understand why I wouldn't let her give me her 3 quarters. Nobody can comprehend the feeling of defeat when your child at 4 years old says, "Mommy, let me help you," when you're supposed to be the one saying, "Let me help you."
Was the refrigerator really that empty, Melissa?
I think we had a pack of hamburger and a dozen eggs. And at that point, I knew we had to do something. I mean, if my 4-year-old's collecting quarters out of the couch cushions, even she knows there's a problem. And that's the last thing I want.
So what did you do?
We sat down and talked about it and tried to figure out how to get gas money and where we needed to go to get to the food stamp office. And once we got those things done, even though it wasn't an easy decision to say, okay, we've got to have some public aid, we went, and it's basically a 3-day process because you go in and you fill out your application. And while you're sitting there and they're saying, "Well, we're going to need your pay stub, we're going to need checking account statements, we're going to need copies of your utility bills," it's very invasive to give someone you don't know an accounting of every penny you spend. And then the next thing they ask for is birth certificates and Social Security cards. At that point, they know as much about your family as you do.
I guess you don't have much choice, though, right?
You really don't. If you want the aid, you have to prove you need it. And at some point, you have to make the choice of, do I keep this stuff private or do I provide for my children? And for me, it was a very easy choice.
Was it awkward or embarrassing to be in that office?
A lot, yes. It was very much so. I was just thinking, you know, all these other people in here need this aid, and I need this aid, but who's to say I need it more than they do? I'm fortunate in the job market right now that both of us have a job. And a lot of the people there are not so fortunate. They've lost their jobs. They're disabled and they can't get a job. And to me, it feels like those people need this aid so much more than I do. But for some reason, the economy won't allow me to get my two ends together.
Your work, Melissa, is taking care of someone who's disabled, and your husband has a job at Staples, right?
Correct.
Did the people at the food stamp office ask you why that wasn't enough, or are you asking yourself why that's not enough?
I'm asking myself why that's not enough. I think the people at the food stamp office over the years have come to realize that you can work and work and work And sometimes what you do just doesn't make it. But to me, it's like, I don't make great money, but what I make's okay if it were a family of two or three. But for a family of five, it's not a whole lot.
Is it an hourly wage, Melissa?
It is.
Do you mind me asking what they pay you?
$10 an hour.
Uh-huh. And what's your husband making at Staples?
$9 an hour.
Uh-huh. And are you guys both getting your 40 hours plus or minus a week?
He gets between 20 and 25. I get 35 to 40. And I get paid a mileage, but I only get paid 32.9 cents a mile, and I can't go over 100 miles a week.
So you end up paying a fair amount out of your own pocket for gas?
Right.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Melissa Hilliard and her husband Randy aren't just paying more for gas. They're also paying more for food and rent and utilities and phone. Melissa did qualify for food stamps, but even that bit of help was made more complicated by some trouble she was having earlier in her marriage. Here's how Melissa explains it.
We got $470.
$470 a month? Is that what they were giving you in stamps?
Yes. I was able to keep that amount for almost a year. And then my husband, we had been separated for a while. So I got the 470. And then when he came back into the house and there was his income, even though my rent went up and my utilities went up because we have a bigger house, my food stamps dropped from 470 to 170 a month.
What was their explanation for that? Was it your husband returning with his income? Was that basically what they said?
It was him returning with his income, even though it's only maybe $500 a month. And then, you know, I'm spending $200 plus a week for gas. It doesn't equate.
You started out at $470 a month, but you got cut back to $170 a month. What was that day like?
I cried. I got the letter out of the mailbox, and I was sitting at a red light reading it. And I just started crying. I called my husband and I was like, even though we're trying as hard as we can and our rent and our utilities have gone up, we got a drastic cut in food stamps. It meant that I had no option but to go to the area food bank and get whatever they give me and figure out how I stretch that.
When did you make your first trip to the food bank?
About a month and a half ago. It was very daunting. I went in and they were very friendly, very understanding, but it still didn't take that I'm never going to make it, I'm never going to get out of this whole feeling away from me. At that point, it was kind of rock bottom, and when you look at it from the perspective of walking into a food pantry, it's like there's no looking up at that point. I pay my rent, I pay my utilities, but I can't take any of my money and go get groceries. No matter how hard I work, even I think if I were to take a second job, then I'm going to lose what little food stamps I get. Once you get any extra income, they start taking away what you're getting in assistance, so you can never break that cycle of needing assistance.
And you've been living in that neighborhood now, Melissa, for almost a year and a half. Is that right?
Yes.
I'm just wondering if when you go to the food bank, you're thinking, you know, I'm going to see someone I know in there, or someone who knows me is going to see me going in there.
I don't know many people down here in Georgia, but that feeling is there that one of the few people I do know might be there and be like, well, what are you doing here? And I don't know if I would be able to explain it without just looking at them and crying.
And you've got most of your family still in North Carolina. Did you tell them that you're getting food stamp money and you're going to the food bank?
I did. My parents were pretty much, you do what you need to survive. One or two of my friends were like, well, why do you think you need that? What makes you think that you can get away with it? And my grandmother just totally doesn't understand why I think I can work and bring money in and feel like you can still get assistance. You're not better than anybody else. Other people have to make it without assistance.
What do you tell her?
That maybe other people are too prideful, maybe other people don't have three kids that they're supporting that are ages 2, 3, and 5. Maybe other people had a safety net before they got out of college and had parents that had money that could give them a little bit of a boost, and I don't have those choices.
Melissa Hilliard says she's not sure how she'll continue to make ends meet. She can only go to the food bank in Atlanta for 6 months before she's cut off there, and she'll need to come up with a new plan later this summer. What's more, each visit is a reminder of what she cannot provide.
To me, it's a feeling of despair. And to my kids, it's like Christmas. They want to know what's in the boxes. Did we get macaroni and cheese this time, Mommy? And I have to kind of go with that as opposed to my feeling of, I had to go again, I can't do this, we're not making it. I have to kind of make it like Christmas for them and say, oh, look, girls, there's a box of brownies this time. Kaylin, we can make brownies, honey. You can help Mommy in the kitchen. As opposed to, oh, gee, it's brownies instead of ground beef. We could really have used the healthier food. But I have to make it fun for them. Otherwise, they're going to grow up thinking they're never going to make it also.
Recently, though, Melissa Hilliard's tight budget has been teaching her some new tricks in the kitchen, like how to make one chicken breast last for 2 meals for 5 people. I'll ask her how she does that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Maybe it's just the way we report things in the news business, but almost everything we hear on the radio these days is tied up with the rising price of gas and how that affects the stock market and how that affects the economy. It's too easy to forget that the economy is people like Melissa Hilliard. She has seen the cutbacks at work and the rise in prices, and so the increasing price of gas is just one more complication in her life. Over the past few weeks, Melissa has made her first visits to a food bank in her neighborhood in Atlanta, and she's making changes at mealtime as well.
I use smaller portions. I have occasionally went without a meal so that the kids can get what they need. My husband has went without a meal so that the kids can get what they need. I look at what I've got and say, well, if I mix this and this, can I stretch it for another day or two? A box of scalloped potatoes, you can put 1/4 pound of ground beef in, or a couple of slices of sandwich meat. You can chop them up and mix in with it, and then mix a can of peas in with it so you're still getting a vegetable. It doesn't sound great. It doesn't even really taste great, but it gets the proper nutrition in everybody.
Give me an example, if you can, Melissa, of something that you make or that the kids make where you're really stretching, where, you know, you show how you can make food last longer.
Pancakes. I can make pancakes every day for a month on less than $5, I think. And my daughter has said since she was 3 years old, she wants to be like Rachel Ray and be a chef when she grows up. So we make pancakes, and we put food coloring in them to make it a little different every morning. Sometimes we have blue pancakes. You know, I have a family of 3 girls. Our favorite is pink princess pancakes. We've made green pancakes. We've made orange pancakes at Halloween. Or we squish up bananas and peanut butter in the pancakes and make peanut butter banana pancakes. Or she's crumbled up bacon and maple syrup and made maple bacon pancakes. And just little things like that she absolutely adores doing. And she thinks they're great because she made them. It's like, Mommy, I made pancakes. And Mommy's going, yeah, Mommy doesn't like maple and bacon, honey. You eat that. But food coloring at $1.70 a bottle and flour at $2.70 and milk that we get on WIC now and eggs, they don't cost me anything. For that amount of money, I can make pancakes for a month. And then what's left over, we wrap up and put in the freezer. They take them out and put them in the toaster of the morning. And then they get to cook their own breakfast every day. It's pretty safe for a 3-year-old to use a toaster, I think. They can't burn the house down.
And how about you when you're cooking? You use scallop potatoes. You make casseroles to stretch food out as well?
I do a lot of stuff in the crock pot because I can make large amounts. There have been times when we went, because there's not enough donations coming in, that I get 2 chicken breasts and some canned goods. And in order to make that stretch, I go home and I put the chicken breast in the crock pot and pour barbecue sauce over it and shred it up and serve it over mashed potatoes. You know, if you just serve a barbecue chicken sandwich, you can't make it last for 2 or 3 meals. But if you take mashed potatoes and put a little bit of the barbecue chicken on top of it, you can make it stretch a little bit more and maybe get another meal out of it. And I can use, like, I can do soup with tomato juice and canned vegetables and a little bit of meat, and that'll last for 3 or 4 days.
So when you do this, do you ever get the sense that you're catching up or that you're getting ahead?
Occasionally, but not very often. Because I know at some point all of that little bit of food I've got is going to run out, and then I've got to really figure out how I can stretch the last little bit.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Melissa Hilliard has a full-time job caring for someone with a disability. Her husband works at Staples. She grew up feeling pretty secure about money, so she looks back at her own upbringing, and she's puzzled as to why she can't do a better job of making ends meet.
My parents never talked about money in front of me. All I knew at my children's age was that my needs were met. I don't know how my parents did it to this day. That's not something we really talk about. I just know that it was always there for me.
Do you wonder about that now?
I do. I really do. I have a sister with disabilities, which is why I chose the field I work in. And I have a child with disabilities. And it's by no means economically friendly to have a child with a disability. And I wonder how my parents afforded the medical visits, the therapist, the special education. I wonder so much, how did they do it? How were they strong enough to make ends meet? And if they didn't, never let on to us.
I'm wondering if you see things changing through the generations. Your grandmother saying you don't need public assistance, leave it for someone else. Your parents apparently made ends meet somehow, and it appears to be harder for you. How do you make sense of that?
The mindset of my grandmother's generation is, well, we made ends meet. They're not taking into consideration that the prices are going up, but the wages are not.
Do you think that our parents' generation, our grandparents' generation, was better at making do with less than we are? Are we spoiled?
To a degree, probably. I know as far as my parents, they didn't talk about money and they didn't teach about money. So that makes it harder to say, this is where you can cut a corner, or this is where you can cut a corner, as opposed to what I have to deal with as a straight line. I'm still learning those little corners I can cut, but pretty much it's a straight line from point A to B.
You went to college, right, Melissa?
I went to college. I did not get to graduate. I changed my major a couple of times, and then I had Kaylin, and I tried to go back after that, and then I got pregnant again, and a child working full-time and being pregnant just didn't leave a whole lot of time for an education. I'm hoping to go back to school soon to be a special education teacher. That is one of my biggest dreams. But it took me until I was 28 to really figure out what I wanted to be when I grow up.
And then it's a lot harder when you have three kids at that age, right?
It's a lot harder because now I have to work full-time. I have to have childcare provided somehow. And I have to have that study time because I'm older and I don't learn as well as I did when I was 18. 10 years ago, I could study all night and get up and go to class and then go to work and study all night and do that for days on end. And now I get up and I bathe my kids and I dress them and I go to work and I come home and I go to bed. And I don't know where I'm going to get the energy to go to school, but I know if I don't, that there's really no hope. That in order to make it, I have to do that.
Do you have any regrets when you look back at what you were thinking back in the, when you were 18 years old?
I do regret not making up my mind and finishing school. I think in the long run that would have made a huge difference in what I do today. But I've also learned that the more you regret, the harder it is to move forward.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Melissa Hilliard's family is one of many in America that has turned recently to visiting a local food bank. Melissa has three little girls. I asked her how she manages to cope with the rise in the price of all the basics and if there's ever anything left over for an afternoon out, a birthday party, that kind of thing.
Sometimes I dip into what money I'm supposed to pay for the power bill, and I'll short the power bill $10 so that we can do something like that. But as far as birthday parties, when it comes birthday time, I have to call grandparents and say, Kaylin's wanting a birthday party. Or come August and September, it's Lily and Ashlyn's birthdays. So instead of each girl getting her own party, they get one together. Because I can't afford to do a party on September 6th and a party on August 17th. There's just not enough money to do that. So there's one cake, one set of presents, and that's it.
That hard on you?
Yes, it is. It's very hard because little kids want and need stuff. And I have never bought brand new clothes for the two little ones. And at some point they're going to realize, I've never had new stuff. Mommy, why don't I get new stuff? And I keep waiting for the day that happens.
I guess I'm wondering, Melissa, if you feel a certain amount of pride in making do under the circumstances, or if there's ever a time when you feel like, in a way, you're letting your kids down because they don't have everything that other kids do have.
I get the feeling that I'm letting them down because there's just so many things that they don't get to do that other kids their age get to do. Six Flags. We're right here in Atlanta, and I absolutely refuse to short my bills that much for my kids to go to Six Flags. It's not worth the stress of, oh, Lord, we went to Six Flags. Are we going to have money to pay the bills? Is our electricity going to get turned off because we did this? Public pools. We don't have a swimming pool at home. I'm not going to go pay $3 a person for them to get in a public swimming pool because we just don't have it. And my daughter wants to learn how to swim, and I keep having to tell her, well, we can't afford that. And she wanted to play t-ball, and I called to check on it, and it cost $120 just for a five-year-old to play t-ball. I was like, wow. I mean, these are five-year-olds. They don't need uniforms. They don't need all of this stuff. You can recycle the uniforms from year to year. You can get them plain white t-shirts and imprint them. You don't have to buy everything brand new and exclude the kids who can't afford to do it. So, you know, she pretty much just gets to play in the yard and with her sisters. She starts kindergarten in the fall, and she's never really been around a lot of other kids. So I don't know how she's going to do because we've never had the opportunity to get her involved in activities with other children.
I wonder, Melissa, if you can think of a moment when you thought to yourself, how am I ever going to give these guys what they deserve or what I want to give them?
There are lots of those moments. Probably last year, I fell and sprained my ankle. And that meant that I couldn't drive to work. and I got a paycheck for 2 weeks for $150. On top of what my husband brought home that week, we didn't even have a total of $300, and our rent was due. I had no choice but to try to see if my parents or his parents or somebody could kind of pitch in and help out. And in the time that it took to try to do that, I woke up one morning with an eviction notice on the door. And I was like, wow, I'm never going to be able to take care of these kids. That was a really bad low point.
So what do you do?
Turn to God. I sit down and I pray and I calm myself down and I say, there's going to be a way that I can get out of this and I can make it one more time. And every month we make it. Every week we make it. If that means we have to turn to a food bank or we have to have food stamps, at least my kids are happy and healthy.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Melissa Hilliard gets $170 a month in food stamps. She's hoping to get more when her case comes up for review next month. And her family also gets an occasional box of food from her local food bank. Her story had me wondering who she blames, herself or the economy?
Both. I blame a lot of it on I don't have a college degree, but I also see that we're spending billions of dollars in helping other countries and on a war that seems to be getting nobody nowhere really quick, when that money could be spent to serve us better.
You were telling me earlier that your gas bills have pretty well doubled, up from $75 a week to $150, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you see a time when you'll have to give up any job that has you driving simply because the gas prices end up eating up so much of your income?
Yesterday, I told both my mom and my husband that I think sometimes I would be better off bagging groceries at the grocery store a mile down the street from my house, because at least then I wouldn't be spending so much in gas to get to and from work. And I honestly think that's going to be something I have to consider in the future, because I just don't see the equation working out the way it is.
What kind of money would you make bagging groceries, Melissa?
$7 or $8, maybe. It would be a huge pay cut. But if you look at it from the standpoint of what I'm spending in gas and what the pay cut would be, I think I'd still come out a little bit more ahead to take the pay cut.
You wouldn't be doing that kind of mental health work, working with disabled people, the kind of thing that you like to do, though.
Yeah, that giving up the part of the job I love and seeing leaps and bounds in people that other people think can't do it would be very depressing for me.
But I guess you have to make those decisions based on money.
You do.
Despite all this, Melissa, how are the girls doing?
They're pretty jolly. I mean, for the most part, I try not to let it get depressing. There are times when I have to say, you know, well, we can't do that. We can't afford it. But they're learning to understand that there are other things we can do.
What's a good pastime for you and the family? Where would we find you some weekend, weeknight?
Friday nights are movie nights, which means my husband pulls out his Star Wars trilogy and pops it in the video player, and the girls watch Star Wars with Daddy while Mommy's at work. And then on Saturdays, we watch a different movie, whatever the girls want. We've watched every princess movie ever made, I believe, over 100 times apiece. And that's just something we can all do and sit down together, and doesn't really cost us anything because those are things we already have.
What's their favorite princess movie?
Cinderella, I believe.
Seen it a few times, have you?
Yeah. Yeah. And we play Cinderella, and we play Snow White, and we play Sleeping Beauty, and we scream and pitch fits if we don't get our way, just like we're princesses. They still have the little kid. They haven't had to grow up and think, or at least not too much, and think about what's going on.
Melissa Hilliard and her family live near Atlanta. A nod of thanks today to the people at the Atlanta Community Food Bank for their help with today's story. And if you visit our website at thestory.org, you can read some of Melissa's ideas for stretching a food dollar. There's one part of our conversation where I'd like your help. Melissa and I were talking about how it is our parents may do with less, and how it was their parents seemed to get by with even less than that. Is it true, or is that really just more like family legend? If you have a story from your own family that helps us understand that a bit better, or helps us make sense of it, well, let me know. Again, at our website, thestory.org, or call me at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Sometimes we find here that one story we'll tell will lead to another story, and so on, and so on. And once in a while, a story will help uncover a different perspective on the same event. Here's an example. Last month, I talked with Tim Gable about the anniversary of a military attack, one of the earlier chapters in the long history of mistrust between the U.S. and Iraq. Tim was an operations specialist aboard the USS Stark in May of 1987 when the ship was struck by two Iraqi missiles. Now, 37 sailors died in that attack. Tim Gable, along with 28 other crew members, was trapped in the berthing spaces where the missiles hit. Tim made his way out and was telling me about becoming a man overboard, watching the ship power right on by.
Probably about within an hour, I found a life ring.
At this point, is the ship out of sight?
Oh, it's gone. Long gone. There's nothing there.
Maybe this is a stupid question, but do you think, all right, here we are, four guys, we're in the ocean and we're bleeding, we're going to attract sharks?
Absolutely. Sea snakes and sharks.
Sea snakes?
It was sea snakes. If they bite you, you're dead.
Now, Michael Tooker was also aboard the USS Stark that night, and he was listening to the story when Tim was on the radio, and Mike called our program.
Hey, Mr. Gordon. I'm listening to your story about the USS Stark on the radio right now. My name is Mike Tooker, and I am the person who threw the life ring to the individual who spent the night in the life ring. I'm a retired Navy commander, and I'd love to talk to this individual at some point.
Well, this was too good to be true. I invited Mike Tooker to a studio to tell me how he caught the story of the Stark.
It was interesting that I never really turned my radio on during work, but I had just completed an inspection for the junior ROTC program I run, and I was really tired. I sat down, closed my office door, and I reached to my radio, and I pressed the button, and the next thing I heard literally 3 seconds into the radio being on was the fact that Tim was coming on to talk, and wow. My wife called me literally seconds later because she was listening to the same story in the car, and she was in tears, actually. So, because that whole time brings back such emotion.
Mike Tooker's experience with the missile attack was both similar and different from Tim's. Tim Gable was in his bunk when the missile hit, and Michael was still up.
We were all eating popcorn and watching the cruise movie, and so we were at our usual state of non-flying, which was essentially watching the movie and eating popcorn. And in this case, it was a Chuck Norris B-movie that he had. And in this particular sequence that we were watching, and I remember it extremely clearly, the evil terrorist had just landed along the coast of Florida in these World War II-type landing craft and taken up driving around the neighborhoods of unsuspecting USA in the back of these trucks. And in one particular case, the evil and maniacal terrorist had been looking in the evening on a unsuspecting family that was setting up for their Christmas holidays, decorating the tree as a group. And with a smirk and a grin, they fired off a rocket rappel grenade into the living room with great explosions.
I see you down.
It was exactly at that time that the first missile hit us. Of course, the first missile didn't explode. It ripped through the ship without a loud report, and it sounded like a big thump. And the fellow pilots and I looked at each other, didn't even break from eating popcorn. And I remembered someone came barging in and said, hey, we just got hit by a missile. No one really believed him at that point. Again, this was before the second missile hit, yeah. And so the large explosion had not happened, and we just kind of shrugged it off. And actually, it was his comment, I believe, that got me up out of my seat, away from my popcorn and my Chuck Norris movie to open the door. And I remember getting up from my chair and walking out of the wardroom where we were watching the movie and opening the door. And it was just at that point, the second missile did come in and it did explode. And I can still hear the shrapnel and the cloud of dust and debris that came rolling down this long passageway. Fortunately, I was at the very end of the passageway, so there wasn't much force left, the fireball and the debris that was flying by. And at that point, I very bravely jumped underneath the wardroom table.
What did you think was going on?
Well, we assumed, because most of the attacks that had been happening between the Iranians and Iraqis at that time were small boats that fired a series of rocket-propelled grenades into the defenseless tanker, and that's typically what had occurred. So we thought there was going to be a number of other attacks or a number of other explosions, because typically the attacks would come in 10, 15, or 20 rocket-propelled grenades into these large ships. Why they were attacking an American warship, who knew? But we just expected there'd be a number of additional explosions. And nothing happened. And so after about a minute, we decided it was time to leave. And so we walked forward looking for anyone who might be in the sleeping compartments in officers' country, where the other 12, 13 officers would have been, picking up the emergency escape breathing devices as we went. And then we finally came out to that same passageway where the missile had blown up, and we found an individual who's lying on the ground, still alive, moaning, and quite badly burned. And the smoke at that point was getting quite thick. Someone appeared out of the smoke with a stretcher. We reached down. We put that individual in a stretcher. And I learned a very important battle technique was when you pick someone up who's been burned, you don't pick them up by their ankles. You pick them up by their clothing, because unfortunately when I reached down, the skin sloughed away off of his ankle. So realizing my mistake, we then picked him up with his holding his pants and then got him into the stretcher and tried to get him out to some breathable air, because at that point the smoke had lowered down to probably waist height and we had to bend over to find any breathing air. And every second, literally, the smoke was getting thicker and lower. We tried to get out to the side of the ship. First, we went out to the left side of the ship, but that's where the missile had actually exploded, and it was completely engulfed in flame and smoke, and we realized this was not a good place to be. Then we tried to get out to the right side of the ship and found that there was even more smoke there, although there was no flame, but it was not a good place to be. It was all quite confusing, and I think when I saw the bridge wing on the port side of the ship, the left side of the ship burning, I realized something was up. But I'll be quite honest, I wasn't thinking of exactly what had hit us at that point. I was just thinking about finding a place where we can get this injured man to a place where he could get some medical attention, and not to mention find some breathable air for everybody.
And when did you realize that there were a number of sailors who were very badly injured, some killed?
We didn't really know much of anything. One of the effects of the missile where it hit, it essentially destroyed the communication, the internal communication of the ship. So there wasn't much ability to talk to anyone nor to get an accounting of people that were either injured or killed.
At the very same moment that Michael Tooker was reaching the flight deck of the USS Stark, Tim Gabel was trying to make his way away from the fire. Now, in my earlier conversation with Tim, the one that Michael heard on the radio, well, here's what Tim was thinking.
I'm going to die. I mean, that's when you know that I've lived a long life of 23 years and this is it. And at this point, I'm out of oxygen. I felt some water flowing. I knew at that point that wherever that water was going was where I was going. And so I followed it and jumped. And I basically thought I had just fallen into a hole in the ship and was stuck in a void, but it was the ocean. I saw a fire hose hanging over the side, so I tried to grab it, and I missed it, but I did yell, "Man overboard," at that point.
And this is also the exact moment when Tim Gable's story intersects with Mike Tooker's experience aboard the USS Stark.
And just at that moment, someone yelled, "Man overboard." And remembering that the ship is covered on both the right and left side by a blanket of smoke, a few feet away from a black blanket of darkness, you couldn't really see anything. You just heard someone yell, "Man overboard." I happened to be standing just by chance right next to the life ring, which the frigates had on the back of the very stern of the ship. And I picked this life ring up with the expectation I'd throw it overboard. But of course, like many things on Navy ships, they're what they call sailor-proofed, tied with a very tight knot, which I couldn't get undone. Fortunately, right next to me was my aviation electrician, and he had his pocket knife. And he whipped out his pocket knife, sliced through the rope, and we were able to get the life ring over the side of the ship.
So basically, you just took this life ring and chucked it out in the water and hoped that it would land near somebody who called man overboard.
Exactly. I know that I pulled it off the stand. I know AT2 Wilson cut the rope. There was about three or four people standing around us. We all kind of pushed at once, so there may have been a number of people touching this thing as it went over the side.
Well, you will also know from listening to the earlier conversation that Tim Gable was the fellow who called man overboard. He was the man in the water at the time. In fact, he's on the telephone right now. Hey, Tim.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm well.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you, Mike? Thank you very much, by the way.
Oh, you're more than – it was a group effort, and I was glad to be part of it.
Have the two of you ever spoken about this before?
No, actually, I have never met him.
So you're hearing a part of your own story then for the first time, Tim?
Absolutely. It's amazing just to see the other side. You know, we didn't even find those life rings for an hour later. One of the questions that have always been in my mind is, how did we survive those temperatures? Now you've kind of told me a little bit more.
Ah, good. I know when there was one other individual who I did speak to after the event. He was telling me he rolled into this pool of water, stayed there for a few moments, realized it wasn't a good place to stay because he remembered specifically being shocked by the loose cables that were drifting back and forth, and he was getting a number of electrical shocks, and so that motivated him as well to get out the side of the ship. He told a story as well that when he went out, he crawled down the fire hose that was actually also in that space, but he still managed to get lacerated when he went in. He wasn't bothered at all by any of the wildlife out there, but he said when the sun came up, the sharks took a lot of interest in him.
Tim, this fire hose that Mike's talking about was probably the same fire hose that you tried to grab as the ship went by.
Exactly. That's the fire hose.
Listening to Mike talk about tossing that life ring into the ocean, Tim, you have any idea how close it came that, you know, it wasn't going to happen, that the ring might never have been thrown because it was tied so securely?
Yeah, it's very close. And there were a lot of things that, you know, we were very lucky. Again, the pilots weren't actually looking for us when they actually found us. They were breaking from one search area to another search area. So there was a lot of luck involved.
One of the things I remember very clearly, later on that evening, probably about maybe 2 hours or 3 hours into it, there was a scene which really struck me as being dramatic. A large Boeing four-engine jet that had the large radar dome on it. That was the only flying American asset that was available. And this was an aircraft that normally stays up around 30,000 feet and flies circles for maybe 10 hours, keeping a radar picture going. That aircraft came in to try to do a surface search using its landing lights and would do a search pattern looking for anybody who may have fallen overboard. Tim, do you remember seeing this thing come by while you were in the water?
I did not, but I did see aircraft flying in the area, and I knew that Desert Duck was not in commission at that point, and so that must have been that plane flying around. And it really kind of mystified us to what it was doing. Remember, at this point, we did not know if we had hit another ship, is what we assumed. You know, a missile strike would have been the farthest from our minds. But, you know, something that we were at war, and then we did see this airplane doing strange things, flying, you know, weird patterns, and it was very eerie.
Tim, if you had not received that life ring or one of those life rings that night, would you have made it through?
Probably, but it really did get us, you know, that moment that we needed, that, okay, it's okay, here's a life ring, they know we're out there, you know, unless the ship sank and a life ring's the only thing left over, but, you know, the life rings kind of showed us that there was somebody out there thinking about us, you know, not just for the flotation, but really to tell us that we're not forgotten.
That's Tim Gable. Mike Tooker was listening to Tim on the story and realized that the two of them were shipmates aboard the USS Stark when it was attacked back in 1987. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. While Mike threw the life ring that helped save Tim's life, Mike's story doesn't end there. See, while Tim was being rescued from the Gulf, Mike was still aboard the Stark and trying to get his own affairs in order.
We kept looking for anything, particularly for me, my wedding ring or perhaps even some clean underwear, which I was sorely needing at the time. And I'm looking in my locker, and I could actually see the bottom three drawers of my stand-up locker. But the whole top of my locker where you would hang your shirts was completely gone. And there was actually a rounded divot as if something large had gone through it that was round. So at one point, I had stepped over my locker, and we were standing in this pile of rubble. But for some reason, it was very solid, and that didn't make any sense to me. So I used my hands to brush away some of the metal fragments lying around it, and I found what looked like a garbage can. And on this rather solid garbage can, on the front end of it, one end, was a number of blocks of metal. On the other end of this rounded garbage can was two little wires. Fred Romine and I tried to actually lift this thing up, thinking they might want to see this back on the flight deck. But it was much, much too heavy for us to lift. And so after we moved it with our feet a few times, we said, well, we can't get this thing going. So we went back and told one of the official-looking people back there about what we had found. They came back, took a look at it for about 3 seconds, and realized what it was: the unexpended warhead of the first Exocet missile. And so here we were about 10 minutes before that, like a cartoon character jumping on top of this dud warhead, trying to see if we can get it to move or do something, which thankfully it didn't.
With a fairly impressive package of explosives inside.
Yeah. I believe it was 550 pounds of high explosives that had been exposed to about 1,000 degrees worth of unstabilizing heat. So who knows what could have happened.
I have one more question for the two of you. And Tim, I'm going to start with you. Does it surprise you, Tim, that one conversation we would have some weeks back would attract the attention of Mike, who was there, and sort of that this one event, this one evening in the Persian Gulf when the USS Stark was attacked, is somehow something that still connects people like the two of you and others to this story? Does that surprise you, Tim?
No, because it was such a big event. I mean, it was such a big event in my life and probably Mike's life, that I'm not surprised at all that, you know, that it resonates with Mike and with me. It is very important to us. And, you know, Mike, I've never met you, and there's so many stories off the Stark that of people's, you know, personal courage and of people's, you know, everything that happened that day and what happened to them afterward, you know, how they survived or how they didn't survive. And there are so many stories, and I'm just very glad that, you know, you actually are adding to the fabric of the Stark.
Well, I totally agree that there are stories which I've heard which are remarkable. This incredible event after all these years still binds us. It's absolutely right.
Well, it is an amazing story, and I appreciate, Mike, your taking the time to add another perspective on it. Thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome.
And Tim, good to talk to you again. Thank you.
Thank you, Dick. Thanks, Mike.
Very welcome, Tim. Take care.
Tim Gable and Mike Tooker were shipmates aboard the USS Stark when it was attacked back in 1987. If you have a story that you find has brought people together in an unusual manner, or one that still brings people together, let me know. A number of ways that you can get in touch with me. You can write me a letter. Send it care of The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive. Three words, Friday Center Drive. Chapel Hill, North Carolina. That's four words, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The zip code is 27517. You can leave me a message on the phone at 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. Or just send me a note to our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.